and welcome to the Northern Soul podcast. I'm Laura Brown. For many, the time of horror has been tucked back into the dark corners for another year. Halloween, the Day of All Souls, that's the time for ghost stories. In fact, the tradition of horror around Christmas time is a much richer and a far more terrifying one. From M.R. James to Ramsay Campbell, writers tackling the nature of horror on Christmas Eve is as much a part of the history of the weird and the wonderful, more so in fact, than the 31st of October. Where has the tradition gone, and what should we do to lure it back? Curl up in front of the fire, make sure the doors are locked, and listen to four Northern horror writers talk about why the Christmas Eve horror tale should make a return. First, Adam Scoville, a writer and filmmaker whose first book about folk horror is published next year, explains where Christmas horror comes from.
If we're looking at the sheer popularisation of it, it starts, I think, with Dickens. Dickens, for whatever reason, found much in the atmosphere in the period of Christmas that meant that his audiences seemed to be more susceptible to more horrific material, specifically ghosts in his case. And we can think of the typical example of the Christmas Carol. But actually, if we're looking at the sort of short form of horror, it comes, I think, when he wrote in 1866 for a magazine called All the Year Round. And for their Christmas edition, he penned his short ghost story, The Signalman. He finds that the perfect time to pitch that and write about it is at Christmas. So we have this point where, even though Christmas was sort of a relatively young thing around that time, there's already a draw towards, perhaps reflecting sort of the weather and the meteorological aspects, there's a draw towards darkness.
John Repian and Leah Moore, a husband and wife team based in Liverpool, write comic books and adapt stories for comics and graphic novels, many coming from the horror tradition.
Dickens is the one that we all go back to with Christmas Carol and other of Dickens's supernatural ones like The Signalman, and that's become tied in with the whole thing through the BBC Ghost Stories for Christmas.
When we're talking about Christmas horror, the name most people think of is probably M.R. James. Christopher Brown, author of The Video Nasties Moment, host of Cheap Thrills at Liverpool Small Cinema, and host of The Last Horror Podcast, explains who M.R. James is.
M.R. James was, well, really an intellectual and a scholar who was based in Cambridge and did some work in Eton as well. He was a writer, but the books that he was writing about were, it was a medievalist, so he was writing a lot about, obviously, ancient history, and is still seen as a very influential medievalist to this day. But every year over the Christmas period, he would write a short story and kind of effectively invite students and friends around for a drink and kind of tell the story to them. Now, this is kind of, some people kind of see that this is kind of like a something that kind of James came up with, but there's been a rich history of Christmas ghost storytelling in the past. For example, Washington Irving, in his 1819 book, mentions the idea of, folkloric storytelling in New York as part of Christmas tradition. So I think it's something that's kind of sat for a long time, and James kind of revives that kind of idea.
Telling stories at the fireside, I mean, we can trace it all the way back to Beowulf if you really want to, and Beowulf is quite an eerie, uncanny story, and a lot of those sort of old texts, the Mabinogion if you're going down the Welsh route, or those sort of things, even though they can be sort of seasonal in a sense and go through the whole year, often their horror, their darkness, their whatever you want to call it, is often in sort of winter time. And there is a sense, and this is especially comes through in M.R. James, that we're going to darkness and horror in a sense of the outside, because we're inside more, we're taking in the sort of fireside and snuggling down into the warmth. And that's probably, I think, why M.R. James ghost stories work in a particular way, and why he wrote them often about landscapes outside, vast dark East Anglian landscapes especially, because he knows how delicious that contrast is between being next to a King's Cambridge sort of fireside with friends drinking, I don't know, port or something, and telling of these windswept dark locations where there are things that are older than our perception of our society is. There's always something older underneath underneath the palimpsest of modern life, and Christmas is when we go into these warm environments, and yet at the same time we seek to partly contrast them. It makes them more warm by having that dark outside, I think.
Where most of us who know M.R. James know him from is TV.
The adaptations as is are originally 5 Jamesian films. The first one was actually a few years before, which kind of makes it up to 6. But if we're talking what classes the ghost stories for Christmas, they start in 1971 with The Stores of Barchester. Now, a lot of people remember a different adaptation that came in 1968 of Wish the Light Had Come to You. Now, these films ran every year, either on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day on the BBC. And then the day before Christmas Eve as well. And they were designed as kind of very traditional in their tone. And they used a lot of very lovely scenery. And the things that marked them out, probably in the psyches of people, were some really lovely kind of touches. So, as we said in Whistle I Come to You, the haunting is effectively by a sheet, which kind of moves away from the slightly grimmer tone of M.R. James's work. Lost Hearts was a far more, you know, slightly more vicious tale, a bit more bloody, obviously, where those lost hearts go to in at the end. And A Warning to the Curious, which its main scare is effectively a man in a black hat and a cape running full kilt towards the poor guy who decided to try and go grave robbing.
That perfect story is A Warning to the Curious in that sense, because it is in the title, and A Warning to the Curious is, at least in his text, is about a pair that are on holiday in what is actually Aldborough in Suffolk, but it's called Seabra in the story, and it tells of them coming across this man who's staying in their hotel who has supposedly found a lost Saxon crown, one of the supposed 3 crowns which guard the coast and shoreline from sort of malice and malevolence. But on finding and touching this crown, the man who has found it, Paxton, is chased and followed by its guardian, who is the ghost of a family member whose charge it was to guard this crown. And even though he eventually, because he is tormented and chased by this spirit of William Ager, the character the ghost is called, he puts the crown back in the hope that, you know, that this will set things back and the ghost will leave him alone. There is a brief period where he thinks he's got away and he's going to leave, but by the end of the story, the ghost is unforgiving, and he meets probably one of the most violent fates in the whole of James's writing. I think he describes the ghost as smashing his mouth to pieces and it being full of sand and stones, which is in the middle of the paragraph it's in is a jolt. It's one of James's strongest, I think. And in that sense, the post-World War I, his ghosts are far more unforgiving. There is no forgiveness for curiosity or the sense of progress. And it's interesting as well, comparing it to its adaptation, which was by the BBC in 1972, because the character in that, Paxton in there, has a more of a financial reason for finding this crown, because he is someone who's lost his job from the recession, and he goes to try and find this crown as a last resort because he's on his last legs, and even then the ghost is unforgiving. So there's this constant sense of almost nihilism, in a sense. His ghosts are unforgiving to those who pry.
It wasn't just M.R. James that you could see on TV, of course, in the 70s. This was a rich period of horror, particularly around Christmas time.
After a number of Jamesian adaptations, they moved away from him. And they did The Signalman, which is the Charles Dickens story, which kind of followed a similar kind of vibe to the story itself, while shifting around it, about a signalman who sees premonitions of terrible things that happen, and in the end kind of sees a premonition for himself of what will happen to him. The interesting thing about the original Dickens story of The Signalman was that the readers will have kind of understood a lot more in terms of the kind of crashes they were talking about. Dickens himself was involved in a crash in Kent the year before and was kind of lucky to get to walk away from it. So, but with the story of on the BBC kind of sphere for Christmas. It was very much played up in a gothic style, which matched a lot of the TV that was going on the BBC at that point. So TV shows like Supernatural, Dead of Night, both these kind of things kind of used a gothic style and to tell a ghost story or horror story. And a lot of this came from, you know, the fact that the BBC were willing to invest in one-off stories in formats like Play for Today, which, you know, frequently stepped into horror terms with things like Robin Redbreast and Fender's Pen as well.
It's better to see the 70s and perhaps the late 60s as well in television in general as a place where genre is totally accepted. This may have something to do with the fact that there were only three channels at this point, and so they basically anything that they'd show would be watched. There'd be very little, if no competition. But there is a strain of very weird programs, which range from programs aimed at children to all the way to adults, that seem to just sprout, and especially around Christmas. And they don't even need to be wintry either. There's In the Ghost Story for Christmas slot, as you said, Lawrence Gordon Clark directed all of those M.R. James adaptations and the Charles Dickens adaptation of The Signalman. And then his last one for the BBC was this very strange story called Stigma, which is actually a real sort of feminist story about the Avebury Stone Circle, where there's a ghost of a sacrificed woman is unleashed by lifting up one of the stones. And it's a really sort of summary view of Avebury, and the ghost manifests through possessing the main character, the woman's body, and she bleeds from wounds that aren't there on her body. And there's this whole sort of it's really quite progressive in many ways, and yet this was not only was it progressive, but it was summery as well, and it was shown at Christmas in, I think, 1977. Now, it's really difficult to explain why that was so normalised, but then if we look back at the rest of television in that period, viewers were bombarded almost weekly by strange fantasy, strange horror, all through the year. So they had, you know, Doctor Who consistently, they had the BBC Ghost Stories, they had anthology horror series like Armchair Thriller and Thriller, we had tons of one-off Play for Today episodes that touched upon horror in a variety of ways, and just tons of fantasy series, constant fantasy. And so when you've got that mentality throughout the whole year, then it's, I think, with the fact that I think Christmas very naturally leans to this darker strain, then all of a sudden, you know, you're going to get lots of strange, frankly weird programming choices. And, you know, in hindsight, that's absolute goldmine.
Currently, there is some resurgence into Jamesian culture. Ramsay Campbell, another Northern horror writer, has written extensively in a Jamesian style. Mark Gatiss has made several M.R. James adaptations. So there's definitely some interest in revising both the style and the format. John and Leia have just published a new book. It's the first in their adaptations of M.R. James stories, Ghost Stories of an Antiquity, Volume 1. This first volume includes Lost Hearts, The Mezzotint, The Ash Tree, and Canon Alberic's Scrapbook. A second volume of another four stories will come out in 2017.
To begin with, the main thing we were worried about is that to the sort of uninitiated or the kind of casual James reader, you might think that he's a bit meandering. You might think that he goes off at tangents and it's all very conversational because it was written to be read out loud. And he sort of scripted his own speech patterns into it and his own kind of normal way of talking to people. So you might think that there's a fair bit of editing to be done, and it turns out there isn't, because a lot of that is very deliberate. It's about getting you into the story and bringing you into that world where somebody is telling you these stories in confidence, because a lot of his stories are stories about people that you are supposed to know. Well, I'm your friend and I'm telling you this story. I shouldn't really be telling you this story about, you know, so-and-so, he's a friend of a friend. But actually, as it turned out, he's very, very easy to adapt. He's probably the easiest author we've done because he's an incredibly visual writer. A lot of people talk about James and how there is all this kind of things happening just in the corner of the eye, and there's a lot of hinted at horrors, and that is all true, but those are sort of directly in contrast with the very explicit horrors that are in every one of his stories. And he does these incredible descriptions. When he wants you to see something, he does a very clear description of it. And if he doesn't want you to see something, he explains how you haven't quite seen it. So actually translating that into comics has been a lot easier than we imagined it was going to be. We thought we were going to have to do a lot of stuff where we'd kind of interpret what he'd written and see if we could come up with a way of visually representing it. And it turns out he's already done it. He paints amazing pictures in your mind, you know, from doing Lovecraft and Lovecraft saying, it was a bit like this, it was a bit like that, but I can't really describe it, as he always does. It's the head of an elephant and the body of an anteater, and you know, it's 55 stories high kind of thing. M.R. James is just like, it's a horrible hairy thing crawling along the floor next to me, and then he'll go into details of what its arms and legs look like and what its face looks like. He actually, if he wants you to see something horrifying, he explains it in great detail. So it's, you know, sometimes in some of the stories, when it came to actually describing the sort of the ghost or the demon or whatever it is to the artist, we just used James's description because he did such a good job of it.
The only thing that we were slightly daunted about, which is the same with Stoker or with, you know, with Holmes, or, you know, when you get to have a go with a like a really well-known story or a really well-known kind of property, then the anxiety is always that you're playing to a crowd of super fans. We always have to imagine that, you know, obviously we have to keep in mind, is this going to be accessible to somebody who's never read M.R. James? But also, you don't want the kind of the core M.R. James fans that are like, oh, have you seen this? Have you seen this? To be sat there kind of astonished and horrified because it's so terrible. We really want to, the super fans that we want to, and we want them to kind of relish it rather than yeah, feel like it's been invaded on or
intruded. We want it to be
on
a new way of that for them to enjoy it, as opposed to what we always say with our adaptation is we're trying to preserve as much as we can and be as faithful as we can. We're not really into reinterpreting or reinventing stuff. I mean, we can do that, and we do that in different ways, but when we're doing this kind of literature into graphic novels or comics, then we always try and do the most faithful adaptation we can, because we want to preserve basically the writer's original intent. And so hopefully
and the atmosphere, yeah, and the pacing and the, yeah, language and all of those things that give you the experience of an M.R. James story that, you know, recognisably, yes, you could set it in, you know, the modern day and have everybody speaking in modern dialect and just preserve the plot elements. And that would be, you know, it'd be a valid response, but it would definitely be a different thing. It would make you feel different when you read it or watched it or whatever. So we would try and, you know, we try and, I think that sort of his language and the atmosphere that he creates with it is the most kind of, it's one of the most enjoyable and recognisable things about his work, and I think that we definitely try and keep that.
The book itself and each of the stories are delivered in quite a distinctive style. Even a different illustrator was used for each adapted story.
When it came to picking the illustrators for it, I mean, we already had Alastair Wood in mind because he'd already done some illustrations and he'd done some art, hadn't he, that was sort of M.R. James based, but the others, we basically kind of try and get a really good mix of different types of people and different types of art into there, and we wanted to try as many different types. Like Fouad, who did the mezzotint, his style fits absolutely perfectly because it looks like a woodcut or a lithograph, or it looks really, it's really clean and clear, and so. But do you know that I have to admit, it was more by luck than judgment. We were like, oh yeah, he'd do a great job of that. He would do an amazing job of that. But when we got the art back, we were just like, wow, this is, he's knocked it out of the park. He's really, the thing about the mezzotint particularly is that it's the subtle change of the picture. And so we were trying to, we were thinking, how do you make that dramatic? You know, when you're listening to it and they tell you, it's this like tiny little chilling detail, like, oh, and the wind is open, and that makes you go all like funny down your back, and you know, it feels horrible. But how do you show that? And the one thing we did try and do with that strip was make sure that the panel that has the print on it is in the same place on as many pages as possible, so that you'd almost get like a flickbook effect when you were reading through it. So that, because with comics you have to kind of weigh up how much you show and how much you tell, and the sort of counterpoint between the words and the text, and in a story that is about a picture, we wanted to make sure that the picture was like a fixed thing in the story and on the page. Yeah. So that when the details in it changed, that was the...
And if you flick back and forth, which you naturally do in a comic, so that you could go, what was it like last time? We wanted it to be locked in that position so you could see that easily. But, you know, the Mezzotint and Canon Albrick, two stories in the book, which are both basically about haunted pictures. And that's a big Jamesian theme, haunted pictures, which is another reason why I think it's a really... His stuff's really good for doing as comics, because sort of part of the terror of these original stories is like, oh, imagine if you could see that picture. Imagine the horror of looking at that picture, and then we get to go, right, now draw the picture, which is, you know, a nice position to be in.
And even though this book is in a different medium from those 70s BBC adaptations of M.R. James, they cast a long shadow.
When we were doing Whistle and I'll Come to You, which is in the next volume, because we scripted all of them in one go, just got them all scripted and handed in. So Whistle and I'll Come to You, we've already handed in. But when we had that to do, it was a challenge not to just, you know, dump all of those lovely, beautiful shots from the TV adaptation out onto the page. And also to realise that comics, even though both comics and TV are visual, comics is a static medium, and the page itself is like your unit of, you know, your storytelling unit. You've got to fit so many panels onto a page and so much action onto a page, and it really matters with the reading flow whether you finish a scene just, you know, on the before the page turn or after the page turn. So we had to kind of find a way of breaking the shots down and breaking the story down visually that was as terrifying as the famous TV adaptation is.
Yeah.
But make sure that it worked specifically for comics. And I think the TV, the scene that I remember, there's two scenes that you remember the most from the TV scene adaptation, which is the beach and the bedroom. And the beach is shown in the on the screen, where you see, you know, it's very choppy. You're like right behind him, right next to his face as he's like panting, and then you're far away so you can see the tiny figures, and then you're like close again and you're alongside, and it's very choppy and kind of it's very claustrophobic and panicky. And it's very, the thing that we realized was that comics is kind of, that's how you chop comics up action wise anyway. If you think of, you know, a page of comic, you vary the shots, you have a long shot, you have something very close, you it is very similar to that. And we thought it's not going to come across the same. So with Whistle and I'll Come to You, we decided on almost a static shot where the figures change very incrementally.
Yeah, they're moving through they're moving through a fixed landscape, as opposed to the fast cut in between, because the fast cutting means one thing in television and film. It's these varying perspectives, whereas in comics, those cuts, a small shot of a face, a long shot of the landscape, they don't mean the same thing. That isn't a fast cut. That's
specifically because there's no sound accompanying them, so you haven't got the audio track to kind of be the linking thing through that. So we thought if we kept it with a static point of view on some of those, I think it's on the beach scene, isn't it? A static point of view, that it would hopefully, well, I hope people haven't seen it yet and it's not even been drawn yet, but the idea is that there's this kind of, you're helplessly watching the inexorable sequence of events play out, and you can't, you're too far away to stop it.
There's the pursuit, and it's getting closer to you as well.
Yeah.
It was just a joy.
able to make these traditional Christmas horror stories relevant and engaging is part of passing this tradition on. Those of us in our 30s, we grew up in the 80s and we had plenty of horror to enjoy, often primetime TV.
I think, I was maybe 4 or 5 when Box of Delights came out, which is an adaptation of the John Mansford book, which sits in a kind of a fantasy world, really, with, you know, people talking mice and animals and that kind of thing. But at the same time, there are kind of horror elements. The baddies want to just eradicate Christmas so they can gain power over the country. And then that still stuck in my mind.
Box of Delights is an interesting one, actually. There are lots of... there's a general perception that this type of television begins to die down in the 80s, and it happens in sort of little fits and sparks rather than as a constant stream. But you're right, when it does occur in the 80s, it often occurs aimed at a younger audience, but not really bothering to change anything to take into account that they may not, you know, understand certain themes, or they might just be too scary. And this is something that happens throughout television in this period, from the sort of 60s onwards, where children's television is actually just as scary and just as, you know, warped and weird and questioning as anything for adults at the same time. So if we consider that the first ever colour production for Granada was an adaptation of Alan Garner's The Owl Service, which is in essence a story about an incestuous love triangle between teenagers becoming manifest through the spirit of the Welsh tales of the Mabinogion taking control. That was aimed at, you know, an audience of maybe sort of 12 years old-ish. And that was on early in the day. It was designed for a young audience. And yeah, that was the norm in 1969. Why that was, I genuinely don't know. But it's something that I think... I'm perfectly happy to be nostalgic about it, because these are great, great bits of horror and fantasy that I don't think is produced in the same way anymore.
The ultimate Christmas ghost story is A Christmas Carol. And if you take away all like the Christmas elements of that, it's a gothic ghost story. Very traditional in its manner. Pre-Jamesian in that sense of ghost, and similar in the sense to the Signalman of, you know, spirits coming to warn of a future event. If Ebenezer, if you don't change your age, you're doomed for eternity. Or, you know, the in the Signalman, it would be, you know, be careful because there will be another terrible crash on this junction. For me, that those kind of horror elements, I think, and everyone has those kind of twinges of those horror elements, but I think, you know, as time's gone on, they've kind of been smoothed out. You know, for a lot of people now, A Christmas Carol won't be, you know, the Alistair Sim version. It'll be, you know, featuring Miss Piggy and Michael Caine singing with a talking rat. And I think that's a shame, really, because I think, you know, the traditions of speaking about ghost stories, you know, as I was growing up, I used to read a lot of those kind of stories, and TV kind of was a gateway to those kind of tales for me.
Mark Gatiss did an amazing job actually doing a ghost story at Christmas, and it would be brilliant to see that return as a proper tradition and everything. But I mean, it was brilliant. It was a very obvious fond love letter to those previous adaptations, and there's nothing wrong with that, but I suppose that didn't really bring it bang up to date. It's a strange thing in terms of, if you're thinking about James specifically, what Leah was saying, like, if you update James and bring it into the kind of the modern era, there's a danger that it will lose something. It's like, you know, Drag Me to Hell is sort of an adaptation of Casting the Runes, but it's wildly different to Casting the Runes.
I think something happened to television in general, British television, in the late 90s, early noughties, and genre was treated as a very dirty word. You know, we had the BBC in particular have very much more competition. They had Sky, and there is a race to produce content that is as broad and as wide-reaching as possible. Now, the things that we're talking about are, I think, and probably you think, that they could have a wide appeal if they were shown in the right light. But to a production manager, exec, who a lot of these things on paper you know, they scream out sort of, you know, low audience figures and AI ratings, the sort of audience index of what people like, basically. And what we're seeing now, I think, because we have had a few Christmas ghost stories in the last decade. We've had, I think, four. It hasn't had the same run that it has in the 70s. And I think we only had them because the success of Doctor Who coming back, which I don't think anyone really actually predicted how it was going to happen. You know, it was, you know, programmes such as that were treated with a sort of disdain, I think, by the industry. And it's only since that sort of burst that a lot of genre has come back through. But the genre that's come back is often, you know, serialised, you know, series. And that often, they feel in style terms more American than British. The scale is vast and huge, and it's not so much about the sort of drawing room horror, which I think was far more popular when television was multi-camera, when there were fewer channels, when you were seeing a very fuzzy image on a cathode ray tube in a dark winter night. And so that there's a load of shifts that have happened that I think have that have been very natural in some regards, if we look at the general shift of our arts, but also things that have not been not produced the best results for the sort of genres and work we're talking about.
The kind of horror that James does, where it's very kind of, oh, there's this picture or this small artifact, or his horror is very much about the kind of the horror of the tiny detail that you suddenly realise, you know, you're just a hapless kind of tourist meandering through a picturesque town and taking a few pictures to, you know, and then all of a sudden you're, you know, buying this sort of several hundred year old book full of like horrible pictures of demons. And I think that a modern version of that, I think you would end up kind of invariably, I know it feels like a bit of a cliche already, but the kind of Black Mirror kind of social media or, you know, mobile technology, you know, like, oh, there's the picture that they posted and what's that in the background? Was that there a minute ago? Is it kind of, yeah, you know, that comment appeared just after, you know, some, I think you'd end up kind of, there'd be a lot of mileage to be got from that kind of, a Jamesian approach to Black Mirror type,
yeah,
kind of territory.
Well, I think as well it's interesting you said Box of Delights, because that makes me think what something that we are perhaps missing now is kind of the seeding of this stuff in the younger generation, because we're all very keen to revisit these things in a nostalgic way. But there's no kind of, basically in the 70s and the 80s, what there was a lot of really weird kids telly that had a lot of folk horror stuff embedded in it. And
like the Stone Tapes, like,
yeah, you know. Stone Tapes and Green Now and all of those ones. That perhaps that's what we're missing in terms of revitalizing the Christmas tradition, would be something that is more of like the family sit down and watch, but has still got all these weird elements. And maybe, you know, the funny thing about that is maybe it still needs to be a period thing, in as much as that makes it a bit more cozy for the whole family to watch, if they're happy to watch a bit more of a funny, fusty ghost story as opposed to kind of something happening to kids today. But I don't know, but I think
it sounds like you're talking us into some sort of Doctor Who episode here, like
well, that's it. Yeah, Christmas Doctor Who is pretty, Christmas Doctor Who is the closest you get to all of that, isn't it, really?
We'll if anybody's listening, we'll do a 1970s folk horror Doctor Who episode for Christmas. How's that?
Well, I'd definitely watch that. This year, Picture House is a series of horror films they're showing in the run-up to Christmas if you want to revive your understanding of all that horror. And remember, you can buy box sets of all the adaptations we've been talking about. John and Leah's Ghost Stories of an Antiquary is published by Self-Made Hero. You can find that online. The track you can hear in right now is The Coral, A Warning to the Curious. You can read all of Adam Scoville's writing and find his work on his website, Celluloid Wickerman. For Christopher Brown, search for Last Horror Podcast on your usual podcast dispensing site. For more on the best writing in the North, about the North, go to northernsoul.me.uk. With that, from me, have a great month.